Thank you, Mr. Cox, and greetings to all of the brethren here today. Greetings from the brethren in Houston, and happy Sabbath to all. Welcome to our other visitors. Very nice to be here in the area again. Every time I come here, I'm always impressed by the beauty of the area, relative to many other parts of the country. You're living in a wonderfully beautiful place. And we're about to celebrate Independence Day, July 4th, our national holiday, when we pause to think and thank God for the blessings we have in this country, for the blessing of independence and so many other ways in which he has blessed us. And he has indeed blessed us tremendously. We have a degree of prosperity unknown to past generations and unknown in much of the world, such that even our poor people here in this country are relatively prosperous by world standards. And one of the important factors in determining the prosperity of a nation is its economic system and how it works. In this country and in other countries of the world, we see continual arguments about the economic system and how it should be administered. What should be the role of government? Should the government be more active in the economy, or should it just get out of the way? What should be the tax rates? How intensely or how lightly should business and the economic system in general be regulated? Through history, we have seen everything from communist rule, with the government seizing private businesses and owning virtually everything, to almost totally unregulated capitalism with virtual economic anarchy and everything in between. But what does God have to say about how the economic system should be run? What laws did he give to ancient Israel, which likely will be reinstated in some form when Christ comes to earth to establish his kingdom? In this sermon, I would like to show what God says about the economic system through the pages of his word, and we might title it simply, What the Bible Tells Us About the Economic System. The most basic biblical rule of the economic system is summed up in Exodus chapter 20, verse 15. Exodus 20, verse 15. It's the famous eighth commandment. You shall not steal. We are not to take that which rightfully belongs to another. And if we go down to the 10th commandment in verse 17, it adds another layer of protection. We're not to covet something, we're not to want something which belongs to another, to the extent that we might become willing to steal it. From these two commandments, we can see that the Bible recognizes the sanctity of private property. Socialism and communism are not the biblical way. In sharp contrast to biblical principles, Karl Marx, who was an atheist, summed up the idea of communism as the abolition of private property. If we look in Acts chapter 4, starting in verse 32, this verse is sometimes used to support the idea of communism, but it doesn't. Acts chapter 5, verse 4. I'm sorry, Acts chapter 4, rather, verse 32, starting. We will go to 5 later. Now the multitude, verse 32 of Acts 4, now the multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul. Neither did anyone say that any of the things he possessed was his own, but they had all things in common. Going to verse 34, nor was there anyone among them who lacked, for all who were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold and laid them at the apostles' feet, and they distributed to each as anyone had need. now where it was private property being abolished. Let's look over to chapter 5, verse 4, Acts 5, verse 4. When Ananias sold a field and he kept back part of the proceeds, there was nothing particularly wrong with that if he needed to, but he wasn't supposed to lie about it. Looking in Acts chapter 5, verse 4, when Peter said to Ananias, referring to the field and the money from it, "While it remained, was it not your own? And after it was sold, was it not in your own control? Why have you conceived this thing in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God." Having all things in common in Acts 4 was a voluntary arrangement, and it was temporary to help support all the people who had come to Jerusalem and from other areas and who had become converted, to let them stay there for a while to learn more. By contrast, what do communists historically do when taking over a country? The communist-controlled government would then proceed to expropriate, which means to steal, all the private businesses from their owners. And the next step would typically be for the government to steal the people's land, organize it into collective farms, and then have the former landowners now work as employees of the state. As we know from the history of the last century, that model worked very poorly. Communist governments could not manage farms as well as the former private landowners had done. They knew the land and how to farm it. The Soviet Union was continually having crop failures and having to import grain, even though it contained some of the most potentially productive farmland in the world, especially in Ukraine. Under the civil laws of Israel, God commanded that each extended family be allotted a piece of farmland which could not be taken away from them permanently. If we turn to Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus chapter 25, starting in verse 23, Leviticus 25, 23. "The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. It belonged to God. For you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the land of your possession you shall grant redemption of the land." This was private property. It was given to the people by God. Now, in verse 25, "If one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the years since its sale, and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession." Someone, a relative, could buy it back for him. "But if he is not able to have it restored to himself, then what was sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of Jubilee," it was the 50th year, "and in the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his possession." This was private property, and if they had to sell it because they became poor, it would be returned back to its original owners at the Jubilee, every 50th year, as we read in verse 28. This was designed to make everyone a landowner, and to prevent the formation of a permanent underclass of landless farm laborers. And it was also designed to minimize the number of people who might starve in any famine. Who are the ones, historically, who ended up starving to death whenever there was a famine due to crop failure? And I'm not talking about famines due to war. That's just as an aside, mentioned in Lamentations chapter 4 or verse 9, famines due to war in which anyone can starve. The people who starved in famines due to crop failure over history were overwhelmingly landless peasants, farm laborers who hired out their labor to people who did own land. landless peasants who had no land of their own on which to grow food for their own families. During crop failures, the landless found no demand for their labor from the landowners, and they hence received no money to buy food. But those who owned land, however, seldom starved in a crop failure. As a last resort, they could always sell their land to buy food. If we look at the example in Genesis chapter 47, although this was long before God gave these series of laws to Israel, in Genesis chapter 47, verse 18, the famine in the days of Joseph, verse 18, when that year had ended, they, the Egyptian people, came to him the next year and said to him, "We will not hide from my lord that our money is gone. My lord also has our herds of livestock, which they had sold to the Pharaoh. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate." Then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For every man of the Egyptians sold his field, because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. There was an example of people selling their land during a famine. And there was a provision that we just read in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 25, that people could be able to would be able to do this if they became too poor, and if they in a famine, if they were too poor to buy food, they could sell their land to someone who was able to buy it. God made provisions for people to do this. And it might be noted in passing that the two most terrible famines of the 20th century, which were Stalin's Ukrainian and Kazakh famine in 1932 and 1933, and Mao's Chinese famine about 1960, both occurred under communist governments, and both were man-made famines. The people had no land. They were organized into collectives. They had no land and nothing that they could sell for food. And note also that the fact that God ordained that every extended family would own its own farm meant that there would be a large number of sellers of agricultural products competing with each other. This showed that it is God's way that there should be competition in the economic system. Competition keeps sellers honest. If there's competition and one supplier decides to try price gouging, no one is going to buy his products because there will be other sellers competing with him and willing to sell for a lower price. It is not God's will that anyone should dominate the economic system in a particular area or the supply of a particular product. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5, starting in verse 8, Isaiah 5, 8. "Woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field, till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land." Woe to those who join house to house. This verse clearly cannot mean that people should not build what are today called townhomes or row houses. There are not many of them up here. In Houston, we have a lot of them, houses that are right next together and share a wall. In the old walled cities of the ancient world, basically, those were the only type of houses that were built in the walled cities. There was very little land inside the wall. People always lived at very high density in those ancient cities. Rather, this verse is an indictment of anyone who would attempt to buy up all the houses in a town so that anyone who wanted to live there would have to buy or rent from him. and he could then set whatever price he wanted. Similarly, adding field to field refers to attempting to buy up all the land in an area to dominate the agriculture there, to be able to eliminate competition and fix the prices of agricultural products. That is not God's way. Therefore, one set of modern economic laws, which do have a definite biblical basis, are the antitrust laws, designed to keep one company from dominating a market, designed to keep the economic system competitive, make sure that a single company does not get a monopoly of a particular market. Remember also that government monopolies can also be just as bad. And note also, under the laws that God gave Israel, if someone bought land in ancient Israel that was part of another family's inheritance, and then he failed to return it at the Jubilee, then the buyer was now in possession of stolen land. It was no longer to be his. If he wanted to keep it rightfully, he would then have to buy it back again, essentially got a 50-year lease on it back again from the original rightful owner, and it would again be his until the next Jubilee. An inheritance could never be sold permanently. We've talked about socialism and communism, but unregulated or so-called cowboy capitalism is a free-for-all, and it is also not the biblical way. Without regulation, people would be free to take advantage of one another in business transactions. The only rule would be the Latin phrase caveat emptor, or let the buyer beware. Fraud would go unpunished. Bad products would be sold as good. Let's turn to Amos chapter 8. Hosea, Joel, Amos, chapter 8. Amos chapter 8, starting in verse 5, saying, greedy merchants, when will the new moon be passed that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath that we may trade wheat, making the ephah small and the shekel large, falsifying the scales by deceit, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, even sell the bad wheat, to sell bad wheat as if it were good wheat. For an example of how a totally unregulated market would work, let's look at the market for an illegal substance such as heroin or cocaine. The people who sell those products operate outside the law anyway, so they ignore all regulations. The illegal drug business in an area is monopolized by whoever has the biggest gun and can use it to intimidate all potential competitors. And this is how all parts of the economy might work if there were no regulations. God's way is one of regulated capitalism, and the pages of the Bible contain many regulations regarding economic activity. God required just weights and honesty in all business transactions. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus chapter 19, in verse 35. You shall do no injustice in judgment, in measurement of length, weight, or volume. You shall have honest scales, honest weights, an honest ephah, and an honest hin. Those were measures of weight and volume. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. If we turn to Proverbs chapter 20, Proverbs chapter 20, in verse 10, Proverbs 20:10, diverse weights and diverse measures, they are both alike an abomination to the Lord. This was where dishonest merchants were buying something using a large weight on their balance and then selling it using a small weight. claiming that they were the same weight. And if we go down to verse 23 in the same chapter, diverse weights are an abomination to the Lord, and dishonest scales are not good. And use of two sets of weights amounted to lying in order to steal. If we turn to Deuteronomy chapter 25, Deuteronomy chapter 25, in verse 13, Deuteronomy 25, 13, you shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy and a light. You shall not have in your house differing measures, a large and a small. You shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. If they were lying about the weight of what they were buying or selling, that amounted to lying in order to steal, violating two of the Ten Commandments. And the same applies to any dishonest business transaction. It might be taking advantage of an employee, perhaps a recent immigrant, who doesn't know the going rate for whatever kind of labor he is performing. It might also be selling cars that are equipped with software designed to cheat emissions tests, as Volkswagen and some other companies have gotten into trouble for doing. There could be many types of dishonesty in business. Key principle: do not oppress the poor. Let's turn to Deuteronomy, a few pages over to Deuteronomy chapter 15. Deuteronomy chapter 15, in verse 7. If there is among you a poor man of your brethren within any of the gates in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother, but you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, the year when debts were going to be canceled, the sabbatical year. And your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry out to the Lord against you, and it becomes sin among you. You shall surely give to him, and your heart shall not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your works and in all to which you put your hand. For the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother, to your poor and your needy in your land. And we'll get to this year of release later. The key principle here: do not oppress the poor. And widows and orphans, who frequently at that time had no source of income other than the charity of others, were frequently called out as examples. An application of this principle was the commandment not to reap the corners of one's fields, but to leave them for the poor. If we turn to Leviticus chapter 19, and verse 9, Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus 19 is a chapter that is frequently worth reading, instructions that God gives to us. But in verse 9, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, and you shall not glean your vineyard. Nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God. That was the safety net of its day. And we might note also that farmers were not to reap everything in their field. They were to leave some for the poor to take so they wouldn't starve. Note also the poor had to work to glean the corners of the fields or the vineyards. An example of that is in the book of Ruth. Also look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. Starting in verse 10, Paul said, "For even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. For we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies." The poor had to work to glean the fields grain and fruit that had been left for them. Also, interest was not to be charged to the poor, who were forced to borrow out of desperation. If we look in Leviticus chapter 25, verse 35, Leviticus 25, 35. "If one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him, like a stranger or sojourner, that he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for interest, nor lend him your food at a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God." Interest was not to be charged to the poor. If we look in Deuteronomy chapter 23, Verse 19, "You shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that is lent out at interest." Note, interest was not to be charged to the poor from the verses in Leviticus that we just read. This referred to a poor brother who was forced to borrow out of desperation, not to a wealthy one borrowing money to expand a business. Other scriptures do show that the principle of charging interest for business loans is indeed a valid one. If we look at Matthew chapter 25, in verse 27, the master said to the servant who had received one talent, "So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest." Also in Luke chapter 19, verse 23, in the parable of the minas, the master said to one of the servants, "Why then did you not put my money in the bank, that at my coming I might have collected it with interest?" That was Luke 19, verse 23. So interest in a business loan is indeed valid, but for the desperate, to the poor who borrow out of desperation, it shouldn't be charged. And how we see this commandment flagrantly violated in society today: when the poor have to borrow, they typically are able to do so only by paying the highest interest rates that are charged to anyone. For example, very high rates on credit cards, payday loans, car title loans, pawn shops. This is one area in which the current economic system goes squarely against biblical principles. And just as an aside, regarding the biblical principle that the poor were supposed to be free to glean the fields of others in order to get the food they needed to survive, we might note in passing that at one time there was one of the cruelest laws ever enforced by a human government. it was a direct attack on this right and a direct contradiction of what the Bible says. And that law was the infamous Zakon Atrioch Koloschach, or Law of Three Spikelets, that was decreed in the Soviet Union in 1932, just before the man-made Ukrainian and Kazakh famine, one of Stalin's infamous laws. A koloscha, or a spikelet, was a handful of grain. This law said that any attempt to gather any remaining food from the fields of a state farm or a collective farm after the official harvest had been completed, any leftovers, anyone who went out to gather leftover grain, that was to be considered theft of state property. An ordinary landless collective farmer, a kolkhoznik, could be sentenced to 5 to 10 years in the gulag for doing so, whereas a farmer who had formerly owned his own land, who is called a kulak, or a former merchant, both of those people were considered social enemies by the government. They could be sentenced to death if they went out and gathered a handful of grain after the official harvest. And the result there was that after the Soviet government, Stalin's government, had stolen the harvest from the people, anyone who tried to glean what was left in the fields to avoid starvation could be punished as a criminal. The Soviet government thereby deliberately caused millions of its citizens to starve to death in 1932 and 1933. And if you've ever heard him speak about that, Mr. Kubik's parents grew up under that tyranny. Furthermore, under the laws that God gave to ancient Israel, the poor, as I've alluded to before, the poor who were unable to repay what they had borrowed were to be released from their debts in each sabbatical year. I believe that is Deuteronomy 15. Yes, Deuteronomy chapter 15, starting in verse 1, Deuteronomy 15, 1. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. Of a foreigner, you may require it. Here's an article about who is a foreigner a very good one in the last issue of Beyond Today. Of a foreigner you may require it, but you shall give up your claim to what is owed by your brother, except when there may be no poor among you, for the Lord will greatly bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance. Here, by contrast, well, here is one area where modern laws indeed do have somewhat of a biblical basis, in that persons that are unable to pay their debts, to repay their debts, they're legally allowed to declare bankruptcy, but not more often than once every 7 years. Remember, the sabbatical year, the year of release, was once every 7 years. So here, our nation's laws do have a biblical basis. If we look back in verses 3 and 4 of what we all just read, if we compare that with verses 7 through 11 that we read earlier, this shows that the release was intended to apply only to those who were actually poor and unable to repay. Because if we see in verse 4, the release was to be suspended when there were no more poor people among them. Someone who was well able to repay could not simply borrow money or goods and then refuse to repay in the sabbatical year. Such would have been stealing. A wealthy man who had borrowed money to expand his business would certainly have been expected to repay. Another issue, another area, we're commanded not to overwork to be rich. if we look at Proverbs chapter 23, and starting in verse 4, Proverbs 23:4. Do not overwork to be rich because of your own understanding. Cease while you set your eyes on that which is not. For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. Note that God used a very rich man to pen these two verses, King Solomon. Just as an aside, getting wealth must not be the central focus of our lives. But there is nothing wrong with wealth if it is used in the right way. Let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6, starting in verse 17. 1 Timothy 6, 17. Instructions to the rich. Paul was telling Timothy, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but rather in the living God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them, the rich, do good, that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. There's nothing wrong with wealth if it's used properly. Also, let's turn to James chapter 5. By contrast, James chapter 5. This was quite another class of wealthy people that James was talking to. Come now, James chapter 5, verse 1. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you have kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, the Lord of armies, the Lord of forces. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you. Note the similarity of this passage to the behavior of dictators in the so-called third world. They were corrupt. They had accumulated wealth by fraud. Note they had withheld wages from their laborers. They had told their laborers they would give them certain wages, then they didn't. They had lied in order to steal by wage theft. Note the similarity to third world countries where the dictators and other corrupt officials amass huge fortunes while the people remain mired in poverty. These verses are really an indictment of such people. Many of the wealthy in our own country and in some other countries, on the other hand, are very generous to causes which help the poor, the sick, and other marginalized members of society. And I would use as examples Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and several generations of the Rockefeller family who have been very generous to charity. They're examples. Another issue, another area of the economic system. How about taxes? The income tax is clearly based on the biblical principle of the tithe. People with more income who can afford to do so pay more tax, as is fair. However, God warned the Israelites that a human king would greatly increase the income tax rate. If we turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8, in verse 15, when God was telling Samuel what to tell the people, how a human king would behave when they wanted a human king. First Samuel chapter 8, verse 15. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and his servants. This was a tenth in addition to the tithe that was owed to God. The king would increase the income tax rate. And we see today that income tax rates are generally much higher than the tithe. And in foreign countries, they're often considerably higher than in this country. At least nowadays, I will give them credit for this, at least nowadays, much of the high taxes are going to help the poor or to fund public infrastructure, which benefits everyone, which often was not the case in ancient times when the kings were using the money on themselves, and is still not the case in many third world countries, as I mentioned a few minutes ago. With other taxes, the Bible is silent regarding sales taxes and tariffs and other taxes of that type. But one type of tax which goes against biblical principles, but of course which we still must pay, is the property tax. If you think about it, it can be the most unfair tax in certain circumstances. If someone loses his job, he owes no income tax while he's without income. He can reduce his purchases to only necessities to minimize sales tax. In some states, such as Texas, where I live, the key necessity, food, is free of sales tax. Unfortunately, I understand that is not the case here in Tennessee. Sorry about that, that food is included in sales tax. But even if a person who has lost his job, he doesn't owe any income tax and he minimizes sales tax, he still owes property tax on his house. And in some states, that can be very high. In Texas, we have very high property tax rates. And if the person cannot pay the property tax, the government may take his house and sell it for a tiny fraction of its value to any bidder who is willing to pay the tax which is due. It's very unfair to people. Contrast the situation with the civil laws that God gave to ancient Israel, where the inheritance that was given to a family was never to be taken away. And we can remember what happened to evil King Ahab after he allowed his wife Jezebel to seize the inheritance of Naboth when he wanted his vineyard for a garden. If we turn to 1 Kings chapter 21, when King Ahab wanted the vineyard, but Naboth, the rightful owner of the vineyard, said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid that I should give the inheritance of my fathers to you." I should have started in verse 2. So Ahab spoke to Naboth, saying, "Give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is near, next to my house, and for it I will give you a vineyard better than it. Or if it seems good to you, I will give you its worth in money." But Naboth wouldn't do that because that was part of his inheritance. And if we go down in later verses, at his wife's urging, King Ahab had Naboth falsely accused and executed and stole the vineyard from him. So we look down to verse 19, what was to be the penalty. God told Elijah to tell Ahab, you shall speak to him, saying, "Thus says the Lord, have you murdered and also taken possession?" And you shall speak to him, saying, "Thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs licked the blood of Naboth, dogs shall lick your blood, even yours." And that happened to King Ahab later when he was in a battle, when he was wounded by the arrow which subsequently killed him. The dogs licked up his blood at that spot. In summary, the economic system which is specified by God and His Word, is not to be socialism or communism, with the government owning the means of production. Neither is it to be so-called cowboy capitalism, an unregulated economic free-for-all. Rather, God's way is one of regulated capitalism, built around a number of laws centered around the commandments against stealing and coveting. Centerpieces of God's economic system, which we have seen from His Word, include the sanctity of private property and respect for the property of others. Also, wide dispersal of private ownership, with all families being landowners. Another principle is competitive capitalism without monopolies. No one should monopolize a market. Another one, very key, is honesty in all business transactions. No diverse weights or measures. Another one, no excessive focus on increasing personal wealth. Remember the verse, do not overwork to be rich. Another one, do not exploit workers. Remember the verses we read in James, the rich who had stolen wages from their workers, had taken advantage of them by fraud. And especially a final key principle that is overriding through the Bible is generosity to the poor. Ancient Israel did not follow these laws, and neither has any other nation. Although some of our laws in this country today, such as the income tax, the antitrust laws, and the provisions for bankruptcy, are biblically based, in many other ways, the modern economic system goes against biblical principles. God wanted Israel to prosper, and He decreed for them an economic system which would have enabled them to do so if it, along with God's other commandments, had been followed. God likewise wants us to prosper in this day, as He tells us in 3 John verse 2. And in the millennium, God's economic system will indeed be followed over all the earth, will enable every nation to be prosperous. Every nation will be the best nation in the world for its own people. All nations will prosper, as was God's will for humanity all along.